What's up, everybody? We're here for Mudball Monday.
If you look at it and really think closely about, okay, what would this look like to come back and play four or five more times? You would look at that green and say, holy shit, like back left.
And then if you happen to get it on a day with really good conditions or in a great season, I think that ranking is going to be really inflated in your mind. And for all of us who have played the same golf course over and over and over and over, it's not that hard to understand that a golf course does have seasonality to it. It does play better in certain conditions.
Or is it the minority of the time where it's like, oh man, this is awesome, but like most of the days you come out here, it's not going to be quite what you would hope. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mudball Monday, episode 115, I think. Apologies for the technical difficulties. I've got the AirPods going today, which, hey, look, it's a tough scene, but it is what it is. Technical difficulties do happen. But I'm joined, as always, by my running mate, Mr. Walker Simas. We're chatting
what up,
longevity
what up?
Of a golf course today. But before we do that, of course, we're going to get into the dirt. Walker, how you doing? And give me the dirt.
Peaceful. Glad to still be here, but excited to be in Charlotte. So, got some stuff coming up. We got some golf coming up. We've got end of year pod being recorded in person, which would be great. It's a great time of the year. Hopping right into things today. Drinking. Some things change, but some things never do. And two of those things happen to be Good Walk coffee and water. As much necessities as food and shelter these days. You know, sitting here, if you're listening to this and thinking, you know, do some inventory real quick. What does my closet look like? What is my, I've got a beans closet. I don't know what you guys work with, but if that thing's low, go over to goodwalkcoffee.com, hammer an order, use code the tie for 20% off. That is THETIE. Get yourself sorted. One less thing to handle. As far as, other things in the drinking category, it's been a very social week. I feel like it's just been like dinner parties and some long overdue catch-ups with friends. And that's amounted to quite a number of alcoholic beverages this week, which has been not my normal, but very nice, honestly. And a few weeks ago, I mentioned Hylize, and I don't know if you knew exactly what I was talking about, but I did a little bit of research later in the week after having a few more, and I didn't realize that this brand originated right out of Cigar City, right in Ybor here in Tampa, and I just had no idea. I've had that beer for years, but they make a secondary high lie called the High Low, which is honestly the best drink that you could have right now. The high lies are heavy. They kind of make you feel like shit. And these high lows are perfect because you can go and have three or four of them and still like not hate yourself basically. And so got into that twice this week, which was great. No sort of cocktails or anything TBD. Well, I think we'll have something for you on the holidays, but for now it's just been cold beer, which is plenty good. Eating. I've had two dishes this week that I've really, really liked. One is in-house and one is out and about. I think I've shared this on Mudball Monday before, but I am an absolute sucker for papaya salad. It's something that I just can't make that well at home, and I hope to change that one day. But to be honest, it's a lot of ingredients to go out and buy to make yourself. It's one of those things where you're better just outsourcing it. Like, they're going to do it better than you anyway. And there's this Thai place in Tampa called Thai Prime, and it's a really nice space to go hang out and have a dinner. And papaya salad was just off the chain. So that was one of my favorite meals of the week. And then in-house, I was really craving tacos, but that's very broad. I was really craving like a Chipotle kind of chicken stock, almost like schmear sort of situation. And I did some beef and pork, really like heavy mince, basically onions, chipotle spread, lime juice, cilantro. It was very nice, and I made enough for a couple portions throughout the week. And I had some like I made some green avocado salsa, and I also got some new hot sauce called Melinda's. You may be like, "Yeah, dude, I know exactly what you're talking about," but I've never had it at home. Like, it's a Cholula equivalent, not spicy hardly at all, but flavor's really nice. And you add some cilantro and some lime juice in there, and you're working with something. So have really enjoyed that. Also, the just classic chili garlic spread, basically. I've been using that on breakfast tacos in the mornings. Very nice. But enough with that. I could go much longer, but we've got more to do. Reading. Last few weeks, I spent time with Ray Dalio's book, Principles. I've read that. It's a big book, and a book that I reference, but I haven't. It's been a while since I really took time to spend a week or two in that book, and came out with a few key things this week. The first is just really spending time getting at the root of problems versus just kind of taking the first underlying thing that you notice. And an example of that is that more recently I've had some later nights where I've got things to do up into the later hours of the night. Of course, I go to bed at like 9, preferably, so later hours is subjective. But when I've been going all day and just like task after task after task, and switching from kind of a pre-work mode to a work mode to a post-work mode, end of the tie, I find it very, very hard to wind down. And I normally need basically 60 to 80 minutes after I finish all those tasks to be actually in the headspace to go to sleep. And when that happens, I'm very prone to, like, I mean, everybody knows what I'm talking about here, just like doom scrolling, or feeling like I need to clean parts of my apartment that really aren't advancing the ball anywhere, or just like doing random shit that isn't getting me anywhere. And so what I've found more helpful getting to the root of the problem is just when I'm done with my tasks, just intentionally taking like 20 minutes to do nothing, like lying down on a yoga mat, turning the lights out, just being completely silent, and or even like going on a walk. And that has helped me so
I'm
much.
picturing this right now. Lights out, you're not in bed yet, you lying on a yoga mat. It's an interesting scene.
It is, but it is just like it's been so necessary, especially recently. And I find that that hour when you're done with your task, but you're not going to bed yet, you add that up over the course of a week or two, like that hour is so important to your next day and your next day and your next day. And I find if I just bite the bullet and intentionally do nothing for 20 minutes, I get in bed and I'm in the headspace to go to bed way sooner than I would be if I just stay on the path of like, high frequency. Anyways, the other thing that I've been kind of learning is, and this has gone throughout the year, but just understanding the system. Like, you want a thing to happen, so you make a goal for it, and then you figure out that there are all these things in your way. And then you have to kind of orient yourself because of those things that are in your way, and then you have to design a way through. And then I think finding peace in knowing that you've understood the system, like finding rest in doing the work required to get to your outcome, is such a better way to go through things than kind of having these many panics each time something gets in your way. And it's a very, very small mindset shift, but I have to constantly be reminded of that it's not simply goal, tasks, outcome. It's like goal, figure out what your problems are, readjust, make a plan, and then find peace in kind of going about that plan. So that included some of my thinking as well. And then also I caught some of the KFT finals this week at Sawgrass, and the wind's blowing like crazy here right now, and I feel like we always get one at one KFT event every year that's just like bonkers, and this one is pretty crazy. The scores are really low given the conditions, and there's some everybody on that leaderboard. It's a big deal for them, but there's some young guys on that list too. We know from growing up, and it's just means a lot to watch those guys battle it out. So that'll close out my dirt for the week. Henry, what you got?
Yeah, sounds like Q School is going to be a true Mud Ball Monday. They got pushed to tomorrow. No golf today. Pretty wet, and so it'll be interesting to see how the mud balls get involved with that one. So jumping into my dirt, it is, I mean, more of the same here. It is freaking terrible weather today. Cold, rainy. A perfect day to be just hammering coffee. I just want coffee on a day like today. I'm going to be inside. There's just nothing to do outside, and so it's a great day to be a mud ball half calf guy. You can just brew a whole pot and just sip it throughout the day. It's fantastic. So, of course, that's from our friends at Good Walk. You already told them the code. You already told them where to go. Won't spare you another one there. But it's nice to be a Good Walk guy on a day like today, especially with the half calf. So that'll wrap up my drinking. I've got some other stuff, but not really of importance. Rolling directly into my eating this week, there's been a lot. I've been in like three or four different states doing this, doing that, seeing this person, dinner out, dinner in. The through line of my eating this week has been chicken on the bone. I say chicken on the bone because there have been a couple rotisserie chicken situations, but also some half chicken but not rotisserie situations. I love a half chicken or a quarter. I don't really do a quarter chicken. That's not really enough food for me. But any sort of rotisserie chicken situation, or you just get a half chicken at a restaurant, it's one of the great things to order. That couple sides, super simple. This is shocking, absolutely shocking to report, but I had one last night for dinner, and some quality control is probably pretty good across the board on a half chicken. I mean, a chicken kind of is going to be within a certain bandwidth, but they just gave me a ton of chicken last night. And I just got towards the end, and I was like, I don't really want the rest of this. So I just kind of, took it off the bone and had a little bit extra today. So chicken has been the through line this week. I know that's a little bit boring, but I've had it in like four different contexts, and you gotta love the bird, you really do. I even had a chicken biscuit yesterday morning. So there you go. Rolling directly into my reading. A book that I've never read before, but I've seen the movie, which spurred me on to get into the book, called We Were Soldiers, a book about the first American fight in with the Northern Vietnamese. I guess Mel Gibson is the main character in the movie. It's a very good movie. And yeah, usually I don't do it in that order. I would read a book first and then the movie. But I actually didn't even know that this movie was based on a book, and so I've seen it probably three or four times and watched it recently and came to realize that there's a book, and so that's what I'm getting into. So it's been a little while since I've done a war book, but one of my favorite genres. Love learning more about Vietnam. It's just such a complex war, so much to be had there. And that's been a good one so far. So we'll keep you posted on how that all transpires. Finally, finishing up with my thinking. You in the late stages there got into a little bit of professional golf. So we got PNC on, which I mean, Cat, Charlie, it's great. Like, I love having Sam out there. I think that's been very additive. But we also have other bullshit going on, essentially, for lack of a better term. Yeah. I got David Duvall down here, like getting on his knees behind his son, reading putts, watching him hit putts, dare I say. He just as the ball rolls. I mean, it's a scramble, of course. It's a tough scene. Of course. At least as of now, we're about midway through the final round. Bernhard is at the top of the leaderboard, which is just like, get out of here. I'm so tired of seeing that guy at the top of leaderboards, whether it's Champions Tour or the father son. It's just like, if it's golf on TV, it is Bernhard. I'm not a big Kuchar guy, junior or senior. That's kind of been a tough scene. The John Daly thing, like, you can keep that. I'm not really in for Santa. So anyway, I'll stop there and say where that has kind of led me to think, which is, when we talk about sports on TV, having done some actually real, not Mudball Monday sort of research on this, and how you would look at any sort of sports league from an investment standpoint, The thing is the media rights. You're trying to get your hands around, okay, what is the value of the media rights of this professional sports team or league or what have you? You're trying to get people to buy the rights to broadcast a particular sport. And so when I sit there and watch something like the PNC, and then I think about goddamn TGL, and then I think about LIV Golf, and I think about everything on TV that is under the umbrella of the PGA Tour, set aside four, maybe even like three tournaments, realistically. There aren't that many things that people actually care about. Where my mind goes is like, what are we trying to do here, right? Like all this money coming into LIV, that's almost its whole different conversation for obvious reasons. But I just sit here and it's like the PNC is on TV. I'm like, where are we trying to truly create value here? Assuming that the goal is to do so. And have the PGA Tour and golf on TV be a more valuable entity over time. I'm just at a loss for words or thoughts on where we're trying to go with that. Frankly, I think Big J is probably in the same spot. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to think. That's just what's kind of been on the dome, what I've been pontificating on. So that's my dirt. That's my thinking. I don't know if you have anything to add there.
I
But
do,
with
real
that, we'll
quickly, before we get started. It would be really great to see a Biggest Losers type documentary on PGA Tour sponsors. I feel like we've never heard any true horror stories of people who have made investments in either individual tournaments or in the tour itself and have had a really sour experience. And I'm sure there's some NDAs caught in all of that. But it would be fascinating to learn more about our past and like what the biggest failures the PGA Tour has had on the sponsor side, or on the broadcast side, because you're right. As
Cialis,
we
Valspar,
Cialis is a blast from the past, dude.
Transitions, those are ones that are coming to mind. Like, you remember the fucking commercials with like Trevor Immelman wearing his Transitions grilling?
Well, one of my all-time favorites is Arcos, which Billy Horschel, their key sponsor, can't pronounce properly. But yeah, there are probably quite a few, and it would be fascinating to learn more about those. It seems like a shipnuck job, but it'd be fascinating to learn more about those as we go into, the next maybe 5 years. Who knows what's going to happen on the 31st? Excited to hear more, but it's not necessarily a guaranteed return or anything investing in these scattered sort of professional events as we see now, and fascinated to see what that looks like. So,
I think on the
what do
the 31st, Big J is going to be like sipping a whiskey, and everyone's going to be sitting around like watching the computers, like what are we doing? What's going to come out here about Liv and Piff? And Jay's just going to be chilling, man. That's where I think we're headed.
Well, I don't know what sort of hours they're doing right now, but as we record here, it's Sunday, just after lunchtime. Are they in a boardroom right now hashing this out, or are they, you think they're taking Sundays off?
I think they are taking most days off, if we're being honest. So, with that, let's jump into some real talk here about longevity of a golf course. So, first and foremost, kind of like inspiration for the topic here. There have been a lot of golf courses to pop up this year in 2023. They're going to be a lot in 2024. They're going to be a lot in 2025. We're going through, I don't know if Renaissance is the right term, but certainly what you might call an acquisition phase from a standpoint of adding more golf courses to the repertoire, and particularly a lot of really good ones. We have some great architects out there right now who have done a lot of great renovation and restoration work, and now all of a sudden there are a lot of people coming off the back end of a bull market here who want to build their own golf courses. I think the model is pretty clear on, what you're looking for from a land standpoint, who you go to, and what people kind of want in the world of golf. And so with that, we've seen a lot of new golf courses pop up and more to come. And so where my mind goes around that, having got the chance to play a handful of these places, well, A, there's a lot of good stuff out there. And B, I start to think about, okay, so like which one of these or where will these courses sit in 4 to 5 years' time? Because it's one thing From a pure architectural standpoint, a conditioning standpoint, certainly the marriage between the two, as I always like to discuss, for a course in its second or 12th month of operation to be really high quality. But to me, it's like, okay, well, is it going to be the same in 5 years? Is it going to be better in 5 years? Is it gonna kind of fall out of favor a little bit? Is some of this stuff like really cool first time through, but then over time, as you continue to play a place, does it not really become additive to the experience? Dare I say, does the trend over time not necessarily look that good? So that's kind of the inspiration here, talking about a lot of new golf. But Walker, I want to kick it to you, kind of starting with a question on, to you, what is it that creates for a golf course from an architectural standpoint that maybe first go is going to be really interesting and that might be rated very highly and people are going to be reviewing in a really positive way, but may or may not be all that positive in terms of looking at a course's long-term outlook.
That's actually quite hard to say. From an architectural standpoint, I mean, one of the key themes that has been talked about a lot in the last decade when we've been interested in paying attention to this stuff and is the crux of what's happening on site is being promoted in real time. Like, I think it was fair to say that 20 years ago, you didn't really get to hear Gil's thoughts or Tom Doak's thoughts on the building process when it was happening. Like maybe you read it in a book 10 years after the course opened, but you don't get it now. And people who are interested in this sort of stuff, AKA us and everybody listening here, it's like the benefit of hearing that in real time is cool. From an architectural standpoint, it's quite hard to say. I will toss this back to you and we can kind of mess with this a little bit. The three things that I think are really important to consider with this first kind of topic, like the course that really knocks your socks off on the first blow, but doesn't have that, it's not set up for a really high trend over time, is the effort that it takes to get there, the variance in conditions on its best day to its worst day, and kind of what the company is like, how much control you have over who you're with. So, like resorts, basically. And those things,
100% control.
right. And those things matter a lot and they feed into what can be a great golf day. And the reason why I say those three is because I feel like particularly when you're traveling to a new place for the first time, it's propped up artificially because it's going to be your first time experiencing it. You've done your research, you've made the booking, there's a lot of anticipation and, just seeing the place for the first time has its own kind of locked-in benefit. And then if you happen to get it on a day with really good conditions or in a great season, I think that ranking is going to be really inflated in your mind. And for all of us who have played the same golf course over and over and over and over, it's not that hard to understand that a golf course does have seasonality to it. It does play better in certain conditions. And if you catch it on maybe the best 25% of those conditions, you're going to have an inflated value of that course. Now, you go through all the effort to travel back to that place again. The conditions aren't quite as good. Maybe you don't have as much control over who you're with. And I think that's a recipe for a course just being knocked down in value over time. So I would say it's actually less on the architectural level. I think that's easier to tell earlier on. Let's talk about some of the new golf courses. So you have Pinehurst 10, and you have Lido, like both built on sand, both obviously really, really, really good for the jump, but different models like Lido's private. Pinehurst 10 is going to be hard to play. They're both going to be expensive, but do I see either of those courses like deflating over time? Not really. Whereas you take a course like Kauri Cliffs, for example, hard to get out there. Like, I'm sure it's incredible seeing it for your first time. You may catch the conditions on a perfect day, and the views out there are basically second to none. You take a great squad out with you. You just have a wonderful weekend playing at Kauri Cliffs. I would venture to say that your second experience is there, maybe a big letdown, and that really it's not a knock on Kari Cliffs. It's just kind of a situational difference. So, I'll toss that back to you. Is there anything on the architectural side that kind of like turns you off? Like maybe that's an indicator that later on you just won't have as much value to assign to it?
I think this is true of a new build as well as something that's not necessarily new, but could be new to you if it's the first time that you've seen a golf course. I'm always a bit wary of features that could just be like novel and sort of eye candy of sorts. I'm always sort of questioning there, like, okay, how much is this truly adding to the experience and to the whole? Not being ignorant to the fact that sometimes that is the stuff that just makes a course really cool, right? Like it aesthetically is pleasing, even if it isn't necessarily directly additive to the golf experience. Like it's cool to see interesting new features on a course. However, if that becomes a little bit of the bedrock of what people are reviewing a course highly upon, then to me, it's like, I don't really know if this is a course that 5 years from now people are still going to be that excited about all of these things, because I think it's important to situate this within like where we're at as a society. I mean, we're going like rather macro here, but when things come up on Instagram, I mean, that's where most people are going to be seeing a lot of these new courses. Like you want there to be some sort of alpha, like you want to look different in some sort of way. And courses that have these new, really interesting features are going to stand out from the crowd a little bit more than those that are just like bare bones, rock solid, really good architecture. And so that's why that is kind of the crux of the whole conversation is like, is that something that creates for a really high early rating, or is that something that actually is going to create for longevity? Now, on the architectural side, another thing that you mentioned there, I guess this goes a little bit more into conditions, but also architecture, that I've been thinking about in the context of a couple golf courses is, okay, did you catch this on a 1 out of 4 day or a 3 out of 4 day? So like if you sit there and look at a golf course and say, all right, how does this hole play today? Okay, let's pretend that we're playing like this very day. I think it's December 17th or something like that. It's close enough to write. Is this the way it's playing on December 17th, which is probably similar to how it plays on November 1st and February 28th, but probably not similar to how it plays on September the 3rd when it's a lot warmer? Like, is this kind of the top of the pile, or is this the bottom of the pile? Because it's important to recognize, okay, what is the season of a golf course? And if for the vast majority of the season, what you are seeing is kind of what it should look like and playing at really high quality, okay, then that's a winning combination. But if you play a course in September that's going to be open between September and May, for example, and you feel like it's at its absolute best when it's warmer and softer, that's not reality for the course across the majority of the season. If you flip it the other way in a colder weather climate, if a course is not going to be very good right when it opens, that's one thing. But if for the majority of the warm weather season, the conditions start to inform play in a really positive way, and 75, 80% of the time, it's going to be the way that you would want it to be. To me, that's longevity. So I think that was an important call out that, like, yeah, let's call it the 1 in 4 versus 3 in 4. Like, is it going to be the majority of the time that everything is matching up pretty nicely, or is it the minority of the time where it's like, oh man, this is awesome, but like most of the days you come out here, it's not going to be quite what you would hope.
That, and I would also make another note that trend over time has this, there's like an asterisk with trend over time that has to do with difficulty of golf courses. And all of my favorite golf courses, I want to play again, not because they are not difficult, but because they're not needlessly difficult. And to me, that is an immediate knocker when there is just too much going on. And sometimes that has to do with the choice of land, or just because that's where the golf course happens to sit. I have more lenience towards that. But when the golf is needlessly difficult and it could have been avoided, to me, that is a ginormous knock and an indicator that even if you get it on a 1 out of 4 day, that this one's going to deflate in value over time. Kicking things to the next question here. What are indicators that this is going to be a course that you really want to return to that may appreciate over time.
Something that I've created a more keen sense of over time, especially looking at new golf courses, because it's an important skill, especially in the lane that we drive, let's say, to be able to extract something valuable from just one time seeing a golf course. Like that's kind of why the people tune in, I guess, is because we're supposed to be able to look at a course and with one time through be able to really take a lot away from that. And so something that I kind of reverse engineering this have found is that if I've played a golf course 3 times and the second and third time, and as I continue to go along, I begin to discover more and more about it from a standpoint of how interesting are the greens, how interesting do different hole locations create the round to be. That's something that can provide a ton of value. And so taking that forward, looking at new golf courses, that's something I'm really trying to scope out, is like looking at each and every green with a pretty discerning eye and saying, okay, like where's the hole location today? But let's not just worry about what this hole plays like based on this hole location. Let's look at some other things and then look at what the fairway is like. And okay, if the pin is here, or if the pin is there, or if the pin is in that spot, like would this hole become more interesting? Would it become less interesting? Am I saying this is a great hole purely because I got like the primo hole location? Am I saying this is not a great hole because I got a really benign hole location? So that's something that I've started really trying to think a lot about with new golf courses. It's like looking at it, not just point in time. I mean, this is the whole conversation. It's like things are so far from point in time. You know, if you play a golf course once in 3 years, let's just pretend that it is a golf course that's open 365 days a year. You play it one time, you have seen less than 1/1000th of that course's sample set of times that you could have seen it in that 3 year period. So I think that's important context. Getting back to where I was. Greens matter so much. Good golf courses, like they have to have good greens. If you don't have good greens, it's really hard to create a good golf course. And so I think that considering what the greens look like, where the hole location is, where the hole locations can be, and how that informs strategy and what it might look like to play a golf course multiple times, that's one of the key things that I look at in just kind of a single blow of a golf course. So curious to hear if you have any follow-ups there, or then, you know, kicking the same question to you, is there anything else that you would throw in terms of how you're looking at a course and just on one look, how you might be able to tease out, okay, is this something that's going to be interesting the fifth, sixth, seventh time that someone comes back?
Yeah, from a technical standpoint, you nailed it. It was like, obviously, greens matter so much. And I think we've all played a golf course or two where, 80% of the golf course, tee to 40 yards short of the green, whether it is interesting or not, it doesn't have to be because of how solid the golf course is within 40 yards of the green. And those golf courses are so important on kind of figuring out what you do like. I think that's like a huge proxy to have when figuring out what kind of golf courses you enjoy playing. I think the best golf courses make you do two things, and this is more on the spiritual side, but I think great golf courses that you want to return to often, whether they're exclusive or middle of the line or really fancy or just really in tune with their surroundings, I think they make you feel small, and they make you feel present. Like they give you that feel that kind of a worn-in shoe vibes type thing, or like that college campus quad with a bunch of footpaths that you've got a footpath to every destination you could ever want to go to because people have been there before you, they've found the best routes, and they'll be there after you. Like it's nice being in a place where you can just simply settle in and enjoy yourself and know that this has been done time and time and time again. And I think that's proof, whether it is just like little paths throughout the golf course or whether part of the architecture just seems to make sense to you. It's more of it's a part of the golf course that you can only really feel. It's hard to describe. I'll use an example here in that I think Pinehurst 2 does this so well. Like it's very consistent. Whether you're playing it in the winter or you're playing it in the summertime, it has a very consistent feel to your round. It's worn
Like a
in.
great restaurant.
Correct. And it delivers more than it promises. You know, like Pinehurst 2 is expensive to go play. It's definitely kind of a it's a one chip event. Like you've really gotta make an effort to go there. But when you're there, it doesn't feel like, you know, you're not necessarily treated like royalty. You just get out there and you're on a walk through the woods. But it's very good. And it's good because it's worn in. It's good b because, you know, hundreds of thousands of golfers have made their way through that corridors and they haven't done too much to it. The golf is simple, but it's very, very good, just like a great restaurant, as you said. And I think that's an underrated and kind of more of a feel thing to discern, but very important. And there's some places who do this well, but also do things above and beyond. That these are our best golf experiences, and they're so impossible to deny because of how good they are. And I want to hear from you know, what some of those experiences are and what ingredients make them so irresistibly good.
I mean, just going straight off of what you said there, like when I think about the Augusta Nationals and Shinnecock and Pebble Beaches, you know, there are a million different ways that we can break this down. But I will go a little backwards to what I was talking about and say that so many, when you really peel through like the tip top golf courses in ranking systems, such as the rankings that we're doing at the TIE Podcast, the top 25 golf courses of Christmas. If you haven't gone there, go to the tiepodcast.com, check out every single one of them. It is the 18th of December as this is dropping. So going backwards here, where does that put us, Mr. Simons? The eighth golf course, eighth ranked will be coming out.
We were at number eighth, and you know, speaking of Pinehurst number two, that happens to be our guy for today. So
How, I mean, we're too good at this, aren't we?
had already plugged
Okay.
it.
So when we talk about some of these top golf experiences, greens are so important, right? Like Augusta, what makes Augusta? Well, there are a million things that make Augusta, but what is like the true hallmark to me? It is the greens. And I mean, let's take one hole, like a hole that everybody knows, the 16th hole. So if you play that course one single time and you get the front hole location, you're like, that was fun. That was cool. You know, front hole location, maybe you do the skip across the water or whatever it is. But if you look at it and really think closely about, okay, what would this look like to come back and play four or five more times? You would look at that green and say, holy shit, like back left, totally different situation. I get to use the funnel, maybe make a hole in one, all that
Like
sort of stuff.
two extra clubs almost.
Exactly. Top right, that's like, oh, okay, so now this is just freaking hard. Like if I don't absolutely stripe one in there, I'm gonna have a really difficult two putt. Front right, I mean, that's its whole different situation. The type of short game shot that you're going to end up having to hit if you don't hit the green varies drastically. So that's just one specific hole, but it's true of so many out there. And it's true of places like Shinnecock and Pebble Beach as well, where depending on where the hole location is, you can have just significantly different things. Going off of what you said there, that consistency of what the product is also just such a big thing. It's why people love the Masters. It's why people love certain top US Open venues, such as Shinnecock, such as Pebble Beach, such as Oakmont, such as Pinehurst, such as Wingfoot. You kind of know what the scoring is going to look like. And it's, you know, what we were talking about earlier of like, okay, so what is the season in which a course is played? And is it the majority or is it the minority in which it's kind of in tip top shape to where it's playing well, like you really want it to? All of these places that we're talking about, when you talk about the lion's share of the season that they inhabit, they're playing pretty nails, right? And so I think it's that variability, but then also consistency of the package. Like, okay, so we're talking about restaurants here. It's like it's a restaurant that's not afraid to change the menu a little bit based on what's seasonal, yet you know the quality is going to be there every single time. They have their staples. You know the three or four starters that it's like, I got to get at least a couple of these. They're going to nail the dessert program. The wine program is what it is. We all know that's going to be really good. And then the entrees, like, there's going to be some variability. I don't really know, but I like the way they do things. I like what the way they think about dishes. And that's kind of that excitement level to it. So that's how I would describe it. It's a combination of having variability built in, that being able to deliver that consistent product time and time again. And so that takes us all the way back to the beginning of the conversation of like all these courses are popping up and first time through, like great architects, we're getting great pieces of land, big budget projects. Like I expect all these things to be really good. Not to say that it's easy to do, but if you go the lengths to put the conditions in place to create something great, these days I think it's probably going to turn out pretty great early on. But I'm going to be fascinated in 2030 to see. I'm not going to throw out a million different names here, but and I have no clue. I've not been there yet. But like we talked about Lido debuting at 68th in the world. Is it going to be 28th in the world in 2030? Is it going to be like, what the hell were we doing? Like that was just a complete and utter knee-jerk reaction, bad call. I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see.
There's so many things to chase after what you just said. I love what you said about 16 at Augusta. There's something about a golf course that we'll go back to the restaurant example, and that it's such a pleasure to show up to a place knowing that you like the way they do things, and it doesn't matter what they have on the menu. You just know you're going to enjoy eating whatever it is. And it's weird because certainty is great. Like you want certainty in the way that a certain club or course, the ethos, the way they do things, the way they approach maintenance, the way they approach hospitality. Like those things are great and important to be certain about. But as far as the golf experience, if you're certain about how the golf course is going to play, maybe that isn't the best experience you can have. Maybe it's fun to have a little bit of mystery there. Maybe it's fun. This is why width is a huge argument with a large part of the architectural community, is that if we design our golf courses and incentivize pro golfers to hit down these 18-yard wide chutes with long grass on each side, it's like it solves the immediate problem. Getting back to my dirt here, it doesn't go to the root of the problem. And that what do viewers want to watch? Like we want to see the full birth of these players' skill set, and you need to give them the ability to do so. And as golfers, we want the same thing with our golf experiences. Even if we suck, we want the chance to suck in different ways. I want the chance to finish off of a certain green and look back at the fairway and go, next time I'm going to hug that left side because I think it gives me a better look into that green. I look forward to doing that next time. Next time I'm going to make sure to miss it short of this green, if anything, because now, unfortunately, I know that long is boned, and that is part of the fun of playing a golf course. It's not the absence of trouble. It's one singular bit of trouble surrounded by a plethora of safe options, and the trickiness of figuring out the combination of those things through 18 holes. It's another reason why courses with signature holes aren't ever valued highly. It's
Sig, baby.
because one cool golf shot or one photogenic golf hole does not produce a consistent result, a consistent final product. And so I'd much rather have six interesting golf shots that aren't that sexy on a camera that you can only truly understand if you're sitting there watching the ball bounce along the ground than one eye candy golf shot or one super photogenic bunker. And that's the shit that I love talking about and seeing for myself. Like when you go out, I always tell people this because I have a bunch of friends who couldn't really give less of a shit about golf, and I totally understand why. But when we talk about the land that these golf courses occupy, they're like, "Why are you interested in architecture?" And I'm like, "Well, you ever been to Florida? That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in pieces of land that were almost made for golf because you can build some of the coolest stuff ever, and it's already kind of there waiting for you to create it. It's already got the canvas baked out for you." And I think whether it's National Golf Links of America or Terra Edie Or even Austin Golf Club in the Hill Country of Texas. It's like whether if a golf course sits in its location properly, even if you don't understand golf or golf architecture or even care that much, I think that when you stand on these places, it's hard to miss what's so great about it. Maybe hard to define, maybe hard to talk about, but it's hard to miss that when you're really there. And I think that's what keeps us coming back. That's why we want to dissect these places and figure out a way to get there. So.
Although I have like nine different directions I'd like to go with that and continue this conversation, we do run on a time schedule here for Mudball Monday, and I think we got a lot of good stuff in there. So I'm going to wrap it there. But tell the people what we've got going today, or excuse me, what we've got going this week at the Tie Podcast, not over the socials, just offline. We got a little golf coming up, and perhaps if people might be interested in anything to follow given our trip this week.
So Henry and I are going to be together. I'll be back in Charlotte on Wednesday, as we sit here and listen to this on Monday. We've got some golf in Aiken, South Carolina, baked out later on this week. We're also recording an end of year pod, and as we come to Christmas, our Henry's top 25 courses of Christmas will come to a close. So if there is any golf content that you want in Aiken, if you will be in Aiken, South Carolina playing golf, let us know. We'd love to meet up. I know we're already going to meet up with a few of you guys. If you want any shots, any of that is inbound. So it
Any
is
follow-up
DM time.
pods, writing, reels, all the stuff that we do here. Varietals, we talk a lot of varietals. We can get into that as well.
If there is any time to engage, it is now. So any suggestions with end of year pod, anything you guys want to hear with what we've got cooking for 24, anything you want us to tackle, now's the time because we can prioritize it and figure out how to get it into our schedule. So we're looking forward to it. Hope to see you guys out and about, and have a great week before we see you for end of year pod. Peace.